Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
From Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford, on the beautiful planet Earth, this is Seasoned. I'm Robin Doyon Aitken. It's April, you know what that means. Earth Day is right around the corner. So this hour, we're thinking a little more deliberately about where our food comes from, including how local farmers are feeding their communities in the midst of climate change. Coming up, producer Tegan Engel introduces you to farmer Renee Giroux. Renee talks about her approach to farming and her deep love of nature. You'll also learn about her work connecting local farms with schools, restaurants, and food pantries. Later in the show, inspiration for your spring cooking. Susan Spungen is the author of the cookbook Veg Forward. She'll share tips for what to make with all the fresh stuff available at farm stands and markets. Plus, producer Catrice Claudio talks with beekeeper Karen Bigelow about building community among Black beekeepers. But before we get to peas and bees, our first guest is farmer Renee Giroux. Renee's an organic horticulturist. She runs Earth's Palette Farm in Warren, along with her husband, Kevin McPherson. She's also the general manager of the nonprofit Northwest Connecticut Food Hub. That's an org that connects local farmers with schools, chefs, and food pantries that need fresh food. Producer Tegan Engel spoke to Renee about her approach to cultivating the land.
Renee, welcome. I'm so happy that you're here with us today.
Thank you so much.
You talk about small family farms with so much love. I've even heard you say that there's magic in having a small family farm. What is that magic?
Just the full connection with nature. Being able to see every facet of what you're farming throughout the whole winter and watching the seasons change along with raising your kids and being able to go in the backyard and to go into the greenhouses in the middle of winter and just be enveloped by this verdant, lush vegetation that's growing. And then to have your kids right behind you kind of frolicking in the dirt or playing with their army guys is something that you just want to put in a little bubble and keep it there, because that energy and that vibration goes into the soil and into the plants. And just that amount of love is just, it's intoxicating.
That's beautiful. Can you describe a little bit more about what your farm looks like? Like, what are the parts of the farm? Give people an idea of what you do there.
So we're on 40 acres. 25 of it is actually wooded. And then we have four greenhouses that run year-round where we grow various types of herbs and vegetables and leafy greens. We have a small outdoor, what I call a market garden, and we have honeybees. We have dogs. We have about 100 egg layers, and then we raise chicken for meat on pasture. So we have a pretty well-rounded, diverse operation, which makes it really exciting, sometimes extremely challenging, but at the end of the day, it's gratifying.
You are really dedicated to farming in a way that is beneficial for the earth and for people, and you're using approaches like Korean natural farming and other practices. Can you describe what that is, and how did you get turned on to this way of farming?
So I have a degree in horticulture, and so I first started out with growing perennials and annuals in the high tunnels and in the greenhouses, and constantly having to don up in what you would call a hazmat suit to spray harsh chemicals on these bedding plants. And then one day I just kind of got fed up with it. So this was back in 2002, 2003. And back then there really wasn't any organic farming in any universities yet. So I found this kind of incredible farm, and I spread my wings and I went and I lived on this organic farm and was introduced to shumei farming and biodynamic farming kind of wrapped together. It's really working with nature and understanding that each section of land that you are essentially a steward of, to really understand how she works and work with the soil, work with Mother Nature, instead of molding this piece of land how you envision things to be. And then just naturally, curiosity, you just keep digging in, you know, and keep learning new techniques and approaches. And so that led me to plant homeopathy with making different tinctures to treat different plant elements, which led to Korean natural farming, which is all about compost and blooming mushrooms and different composts. And so it's just kind of picking and pulling from all of these various styles of farming from around the world and what resonated with me that I was able to give back to the land. So that's kind of how I got on this journey.
Yeah, it's really like nature as your teacher.
Exactly, 100%.
Yeah, and so you're really trying to mimic these systems that exist naturally in nature.
Right.
And so when we have like conventional farming that's putting chemicals all over the place, you're sort of destroying that natural ecosystem there.
Right.
So you said half of your land, I think, is forest.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about the forest as an integral part of your farm?
The forest is the best teacher. Being able to walk around the woods and to be quiet and to really look at all the flora and fauna and the understory and how everything kind of grows together, that to me is the biggest teacher of the farm. So essentially, I go into the woods for not only inspiration, to try to incorporate as much as I can by learning how nature itself decomposes, by taking that and bringing it back into our fields and back into our greenhouses. So that way it's just this beautiful symbiotic relationship. So it's almost pulling fertilizer from the forest to use literally within 200 yards from where it was grown naturally.
Yeah, it's actually such an ancient practice that I think has been forgotten. And so part of the work you're doing is like remembering that and bringing it back into practice. That's
yeah,
really great.
Absolutely. And I just feel like over the past decade or so, everyone's really kind of waking up again to that natural instinct that humanity has of growing and connecting with plants. So it's just such a primal thing that we've all stepped away from collectively. And now it's all kind of waking up in us again. People really excited to get out there to grow plants again, or just one little vegetable,
yeah,
which is really great.
Yeah, it's so great. So one of your early places that you worked was at Gilberti's. And many people in Connecticut might know Sal Gilberti and his farms in Easton and Westport, where he's famous for growing herbs and microgreens.
Mm-hmm.
I think you helped them get started with some organic farming there. I'd love if you could tell
that
story.
Oh, my gosh. So this was 2006, 2007. Gilberti's, to me, back then, was just this dream job. At that time, he was the largest herb grower in the country, growing over 300 different varieties of so many different herbs, coupled with so many different varieties of vegetables. I was just so eager to be going to work there. It was, oh my gosh, this is actually happening. I was like, we should really go organic.
And what did he think?
And he said, you have one greenhouse. If you can certify this organic, then we could do the whole farm. And we did. It was a huge monumental, you know, milestone in my career. But at the time, I had no idea how impactful that would be. It's one of those things when you follow your intuition, beautiful things happen.
And when you were growing there, is that where you started growing herbs for the famous chef David Boulay, who based in New York City?
Yeah. So back in 2013, I met the famous chef David Boulay and then quickly became his farmer and was schlepping herbs back and forth, which was such an incredible experience because inside in this beautiful downtown building, there were so many different herbs that were being grown. And just to watch the chefs from around the world harvest and then make just these incredible dishes that were somewhat mind-blowing and to know that you had a piece to play in that, you know?
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah. So in our world right now, we are dealing with this incredible climate crisis. How is the climate crisis impacting your farm? And what are some of the practices that you're using to try to counter the effects of the climate crisis?
How it's really affected us is that there's no steady weather pattern. Like last year, it was the torrential downpours. The year before, it was just the hot, dry months. On our farm, a lot of our high-value crops, meaning our tomatoes, our heirloom tomatoes, some of our cucumbers, peppers, eggplant, a lot of that is grown in the high tunnels to protect it from the various wind and weather patterns that have been so extreme during the summer months. Another thing is seed saving. Kind of the amazing thing about plants is that they have this beautiful memory that's stored within their seeds. And so every single year, once you take that saved seed, it almost remembers the year before. And so it can adapt. And so the more you seed save, the more the plant is going to adapt and be somewhat more resilient to these crazy and fluctuations of weather patterns.
You talk a lot about small farmers being mighty and resilient and sort of the backbone of communities. I'm wondering how you see the role of small farmers in feeding our planet, our rapidly growing planet.
Small farms are so pivotal because we are on the front lines of climate change, and we're going to be the ones that's going to help offset it by creating these incredible micro climate cultures within each of our town and our region to be able to feed the pollinators, to be able to continue to grow these native species of beans or grasses and all of those things that we need for a healthy ecosystem. By being able to do that, the produce that comes out of the fields is so much healthier, stronger. And so in order for us to advance as a civilization, we need to embrace the small family farm. We need to go there. We need to shop there. We need to uphold them and realize that they're so important.
This episode is going to air around Earth Day. And as a farmer who is personally and spiritually connected to nature, how do you mark Earth Day? Is it a day that you hang out with your kids and do things on the farm? Do you reflect on stuff? Are you just working and doing your regular thing?
A combination. You know, that term forest bathing, it's pretty much just walking barefoot in the woods and being quiet and kind of opening up that little voice inside of you to be a land steward, you know, to be able to really understand what that means and what your job and your responsibility is for the earth, you know, almost a keeper.
When you do that, what do you feel?
A deep connection and oneness with the ground itself. There's this beautiful silence that kind of falls over you. And just to be able to quiet your mind, it's so healing on so many different levels. And to be able to get your energy down to that simple, peaceful, loving state, it transcends so much.
Yeah. So another thing you love on the farm is your husband, who is a French pastry chef and chocolatier.
Yes.
And I know that he makes beautiful things to sell as part of your farm store and other things. How is his pastry and chocolate influenced by what you grow on the farm?
There's different ingredients that are grown on the farm that he wants to incorporate into the chocolate. So there was one year he made these white tarragon chocolates, which were so incredible. And it was just pretty amazing that the tarragon was grown right there. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like he can have a palette of what he wants of flavors and to just be as creative as he can be. Like, for example, when he makes a seasonal quiche, it's all from the eggs from our chickens. And the milk is from up the road from a raw dairy farm, Calf and Clover. It's just really neat to witness how creative he is with the things that he's given. It's a little challenging over the winter months because we're not as active, and I probably gain like 5 to 10 pounds, especially during, you know, the holidays when our house is turned into a chocolate factory. It's really fun. You have to have fun doing what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So in part of your work, you started the Northwest Connecticut Food Hub, and it's really trying to address a number of the gaps and needs in our local food system. Can you explain what some of those gaps and challenges are, and how is the Food Hub trying to work to fix them?
The Food Hub was started in 2017, and we were working with a handful of farmers back then to kind of bridge the need for channels of distribution. We started programs called Produce RX, and we worked with Charlotte Hungerford Hospital. And these programs just naturally started evolving. You know, Farm to School, which is another huge one close to my heart. Obviously, I'm a mom. Mm-hmm. And so right now we are working with close to 27, 28 schools throughout the state of Connecticut, all the farms that we work with, they hit all of those key terms that you always hear. Regenerative, organic, clean food, clean medicine.
Yeah, and how is the Food Hub actually facilitating it?
So right now we're working with over 30 small farms throughout the Northwest, basically like west of the Connecticut River. And we are a massive aggregator.
Which means that you're bringing everything together so that people can bring it to one point and then you're delivering
dispersed.
It out from there. Okay. How in doing this are you ensuring that farmers are getting a fair price for their food and that you're creating a system that is economically self-sustaining?
Within the Food Hub, the farmers set the price, which I think is so important because the last thing we want to do is nickel and dime our farmers who are putting so much attention and care into their vegetables and what they're producing. Cost effectiveness is there, but we still have a long way to go.
You spend so much of your time nourishing the soil and nourishing your community. I'm wondering, how does the work that you do nourish you?
Oh, gosh, that's an easy question. It feeds my soul. It's work that's really humbling, and being able to be one of many connector pieces in building just this incredible, resilient community makes me feel hopeful.
That was organic horticulturist and farmer Renee Giroux of Earth's Palette Farm in Warren. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. It's time for a short break. When we get back, the author of Veg Forward will inspire you to cook spring's bounty.
Fresh peas are a wonderful delight, and they should be eaten very fresh.
This is Seasoned. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Welcome back to Seasoned, everyone. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. This hour, we're celebrating Earth Day with people connected to nature and fresh food. Our next guest is Susan Spungen. She's a cook, food stylist, and recipe developer. She was the founding food editor and editorial director of Martha Stewart Living and the culinary consultant for films like Julie and Julia. Susan's written 5 cookbooks. Her latest is Veg Forward, super delicious recipes that put produce at the center of your plate. The book is broken up by season, so we started by talking about what makes spring such an exciting season to cook.
Absolutely. It's just really the most exciting time of year because it's when everything is just waking up and coming to life. So even though like August with its bounty is fantastic, there's something about spring and the whole sense of renewal that makes it, I think, the most exciting and wonderful time of year to cook because everything's so delicate and new and young.
Yeah. You're not a vegetarian, but you are a vegetable enthusiast. So what sparked your passion for vegetables?
I mean, I've always been a highly seasonal cook. Even my mother used to take me to, back in the 70s, dating myself, you know, to the produce stands that it was the old fashioned greengrocer where they just sold vegetables. We would always have to just come to a screeching halt when we would pass one of these places and get those big Jersey tomatoes or a giant zucchini for a nickel. I remember doing that once. As I developed as a cook, it was, you know, farmers markets were always a great source of inspiration. And then living on the east end of Long Island for the last more than 20 years, the farm stands out here are just amazing and grow all kinds of wonderful things. And so I just drive around from stand to stand to get all of my favorite things.
In Veg Forward, you say that a recipe is a guide, not a god. So Can you talk about that cooking philosophy and why it's important for people who cook with the seasons?
Well, inexperienced cooks do need a recipe to learn to cook. But after that, you should always feel free to riff. And especially when you're working with produce, you might need to make some changes. Like maybe you were going to make something with asparagus. Maybe the asparagus didn't look that good that day. So you have to shift a little bit. So you need to feel comfortable enough to make changes in a recipe. And a lot of times everything just kind of works out in the end, doesn't it?
Even mistakes are delicious. Or can be.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, for sure. And like Julia Child always said, never apologize. You know, if you make a mistake, you should not say, oh, I'm really sorry. This didn't come out the way it was supposed to. Just say, here it is. Enjoy it.
Yeah. And I think with spring cooking and summer too, when you're cooking with fresh produce, some of the most delicious vegetables are kind of wonky looking.
Absolutely. And by the time it's cooked, you won't see any of that. So.
I want to give listeners some ideas for the harbingers of spring. There's really nothing like fresh peas, is there?
Yeah, I mean, fresh peas are a wonderful delight and they should be eaten very fresh. Peas start converting sugar to starch as soon as you pick them. So that is one of those things that you are really ephemeral. So you have to eat them. Don't buy that Ziploc bag of peas. They're going to be so starchy and tough. But if you eat them sweet and fresh, you don't even have to cook them or barely cook them.
You make a pea pesto in a pasta dish with shaved asparagus. And that just looks so good to me. It looks like spring on a plate. So talk about this one.
Except for the pasta, it's a no-cook recipe because the asparagus, when it's fresh and young, it's so you shave it thin. So the heat of the pasta is cooking the asparagus and the pesto, of course, is not cooked. And it just releases all its flavor when the hot pasta hits the pesto. And when you combine the hot pasta with all of those other things, it just comes to life. It's really this like throw everything together. It's magically turns into this beautiful pasta dish.
And the pasta is, do you say it bucatini? Is that how you
bucatini,
say it?
Bucatini. Yeah, it doesn't have to be bucatini. It can be spaghetti, but there was actually a pandemic shortage of bucatini that a lot of people were writing about. But bucatini is just a slightly thicker, chewier noodle. It has a tiny little hole in the middle.
Yeah, my son calls it fat spaghetti. So we have that.
Yeah, that's good.
Another beautiful pea dish is your sugar snap cabbage and radish slaw with buttermilk dressing. I was thinking about this recipe when I read Kim Severson's article in the Times pretty recently about how cabbage is turning up on creative menus across the United States. And I think this salad would certainly contribute to it because it looks like something that could be served in a restaurant because it's so gorgeous.
Thank you.
This is also a no-cook dish.
I actually really like a lot of raw vegetables. Now, some people might say, well, I'd rather blanch the snap peas. You absolutely can. I love them raw and crunchy. So with this one, it was the colors were very inspiring here. The pink Napa cabbage is just gorgeous. And I've been seeing that more and more. Now, this is only something you're going to find in a farmer's market. You're not going to find it in a store yet. Regular Napa cabbage, you can find in your grocery store. You can find it in the farmer's market. It is perfectly acceptable here, but I just love the color that you get from this pink cabbage. And then I have the pink watermelon radishes and together, it just makes a gorgeous looking and really crunchy salad. This is the kind of salad that I could probably eat the whole recipe myself. So sometimes when I say serves four, I'm like, well, I don't know. My husband and I could absolutely polish off a serving for four of this kind of salad. And I make this kind of salad a lot, meaning raw, sort of slaw textured kind of salad that's really crunchy, tangy. It has a lot of different flavors going on and colors. And it's so important that things look as good as they taste.
I could see this too in a taco or on top of crab cakes or something.
Taco. I made a similar salad. A friend of mine came by in the middle of the day and hungry. I had one of those stone fire naans and I put some labneh on it, a salad very similar to this, and wrapped it up for her. And she was just like saying, this is the best thing I ever ate. So you're absolutely right.
A lot of your recipes, in fact, have either like a labneh or the fresh ricotta. Fresh ricotta is a spring theme for you, and I love it in everything you have.
That's because it just quickly brings something together for things that require very little cooking, and it just adds that little bit of luxury and creaminess. So yeah, there are quite a few things that do have a little bit of ricotta in it, but it's important to get good ricotta. You want one that's very white and creamy and fluffy and, you know, the kind that you see in a can with a big plastic over this domed top of cheese. That's the kind of fresh ricotta I'm talking about.
So we talked about your pea pesto, but you make pestos from other vegetables too. And I was so happy to see your garlic scape toast because I never know what to do with garlic scapes. And aside from like snipping them over pasta or putting them in a stir fry, I end up with so many tangles of garlic scapes languishing away in the fridge before actually using them all. So let's make people hungry for this garlic scape
toast.
Well,
this is basically the best garlic bread you're ever going to eat. And garlic scape pesto is a fantastic thing to do when you have a lot of garlic scape because you can freeze it. This is also a great thing to swirl into a hot pasta dish. It'll kind of just melt into the pasta, or you could use it as a sandwich spread. In this case, I am spreading it. That happens to be my own homemade sourdough that you see in that picture. Oh. But any good sourdough, which of course we know we can buy. If not,
we all know how to make sourdough now.
Yeah.
2020.
So you just, what I like to do is grill pieces of sourdough. And this, I'm just putting them on my gas grill, which is easy to turn on. But you can do it in the oven too, under the broiler. Either way, you got to watch it, make sure it doesn't burn. First, you're going to get the bread crunchy on both sides and a little bit brown. And then you're going to spread on the garlic scape pesto on one side of the bread. And then you're going to either broil or grill it again just to get it, not only cook out some of that raw garlic taste a little bit, but just get everything kind of hot and sizzling. It's a good example of how things can be so simple and just over the top good.
It's not spring without asparagus, and I love grassy tasting things. So what's your simplest way of making asparagus?
Well, I tend to roast or grill because I like to cook it hot and fast. So again, I do use my gas grill. I often use a what's called a grill platter. You can get them in the hardware store. That is the best thing for cooking asparagus on the grill. But if you don't have that, you could just put everything perpendicular to the grates and make sure you don't lose any into the fire. So that would be a shame, right? Yeah. Or roasting them at, I think, 500 degrees. So that might sound hot, but if you want to cook them in the oven, you really want to roast them. And what you want is to get the outside kind of a little bit charred and caramelized, and it brings out all that sweetness. But before they get overcooked, you still want them to be kind of bright green on the inside and charred and almost blackened on the outside. So that's my goal with asparagus. And just olive oil, salt, and pepper.
Are you like me? Like, I think that there is a perfect bite of every asparagus. It's the crown. To me, like that's the treat.
Absolutely. Asparagus tips is one of the great delicacies of the world.
So, Susan, you will probably agree with me. Kohlrabi looks like an alien, and some home cooks are really unsure how to approach it, but it's worth learning how to prep and make something delicious with it because it has two seasons. So it's going to turn up in your CSA box and be in the market multiple times.
Right.
Give us some ideas. What does kohlrabi taste like, and what can we do with it?
Yeah, well, it's kind of like crunchy, like an apple. It has a really nice, fresh taste. I happen to love it. I mean, you can just roast it also, by the way. You can make a soup out of it. But again, here's a place where I really like it raw and where I feel like using a mandolin that unfortunately many people use to slice their fingers. That's why even I always use a special cut-proof glove. I bought it for maybe $5 on Amazon. and it keeps my fingers safe. And then I'm able to thinly slice vegetables, which I think is the best way to enjoy raw vegetables, and especially things like kohlrabi, which almost has like a potato texture, but doesn't need to be cooked like a potato. And in this salad, I have it some other raw things that can be confounding too, like daikon. What do you do when you have a lot of daikon? And daikon is that long white radish. And, you know, you always see it from a sushi restaurant. But this salad that combines daikon, celery, kohlrabi, and apple is just crunchy, delicious, and it has kind of a creamy dressing. So again, it's one of my raw creations. I don't know what it is about this kind of a raw salad. It's partly the texture and the freshness is that you can really eat a lot of it.
I made lots of notes for recipes that I wanted to talk about. And I'm realizing now that we're talking that I picked out all these raw things. I didn't mean to, because I mean,
that's okay.
I know some people, if they have an aversion to a certain vegetable, I often think it's because they just haven't had it cooked the right way. People think that radishes are too sharp sometimes or like aggressive, but I'm like, you don't know the beauty of a butter poached radish.
No,
radishes
it's true.
Are so underappreciated.
Yes, they are. But, you know, people who say they hate beets or Brussels sprouts, those are two very common ones. With something like beets, it's just they just haven't had them prepared well. You know, they only had canned beets as a kid. And so they get very stuck thinking that they hated something, or boiled Brussels sprouts or whatever it is. But a lot of times if they taste it done well, they are converted.
So if we could turn for a second from your kitchen to your living room couch, maybe, as a person who's directed the food and cooking in a few of the most memorable food movies made in the last 15 years, do you watch any food TV? Do you have a favorite series or something that stands out to you in our current moment of sort of like having so many different food shows on our Netflix and our Hulu?
Well, first of all, I didn't direct the movies. You used the word direct, so I oversaw the culinary part. So obviously but the most striking thing that I saw recently was The Taste of Things, the movie with Juliette Binoche. I just loved watching that. I thought it was beautifully done, and all the food looked so amazing. Not just the food itself, which did look great, but you know, just the cooking scenes and the way Juliette Binoche moved through the kitchen. And I mean, really, the whole thing was about food. It was incredibly important.
Yeah, I saw it too and thought it was amazing from the first scene until the last. I wondered if there was any particular moment or any particular preparation of the various feasts that were happening that stuck out to you as especially beautiful.
Well, I think about the turbo in that, you know, special turbo pan. I don't know if you remember that, the big fish that she cooked. I mean, that's for some reason something that's really sticking with me, but it was so beautifully photographed. And also the food was so beautifully cooked. I could tell that the person creating the food really knew what they were doing, because everything was not only historically accurate, but culinarily perfectly executed. A lot of thought and research and work went into creating the food. And I know how hard it is to do. They did an amazing job.
It was a total feast for the senses.
Yeah.
If you're a person like me who likes to watch people cook, I even like to watch people eat. And that was what the whole, you know, there was 2 hours of that. So I was in my glory. Yeah.
As far as TV, I don't really watch a lot of food TV anymore. I used to watch Top Chef. I haven't watched that in a long time. Sorry. And or Chef's Table. I watched that a lot.
As someone who knew Julia Child, did you watch at all the series Julia on HBO? And if you did, does the British actor Sarah Lancashire, did she do a great Julia, do you think?
I think she did. I didn't watch the whole thing. And I'm really sorry, Christine Tobin, if you're listening. She was the food stylist on the show. It honestly comes down to time. There wasn't enough time to watch everything. But it's something I'm going to get to. But I think she did a really good job. I think everybody, of course, I was on set with Meryl Streep for Julie and Julia. And I think she did an amazing job, but I think Sarah Lancashire did a very, very good Julia as well. And of course, there are great food scenes.
So part of what really resonates with me in your book is that the recipes in Veg Forward, they look real and really delicious. And I think it will give lots of home cooks the confidence to give over more of their plates to vegetables. Thank you, Susan, for spending some time with me today. I'm so glad I got to talk about cooking spring vegetables with you.
Same here. Thank you so much, Robin.
That was Susan Spungen, author of Veg Forward. Her Substack newsletter is Seasonality. It's all about seasonal recipes. We have three of Susan's recipes on our site. That pasta with pea pesto, ricotta, and shaved asparagus, sugar snap, cabbage, and radish slaw, and because you have to have dessert, the sweetest little strawberry tarts you'll ever make. You'll find the recipes on our show page, ctpublic.org/seasoned, or go to ctpublic.org/recipes. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. Coming up, the founder of Beekeeping While Black talks about building community among Black beekeepers.
We are Black beekeepers, but I think sometimes people forget that that also means we're Black farmers. We're helping the environment, but we're also then helping our food system.
You're listening to Seasoned on Connecticut Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Seasoned. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. We can't celebrate Earth Day without a nod to our pollinators. And the busiest, or buzziest of them, is the honeybee. Our next guest is Karen Bigelow. She's based in D.C., and she's the founder of Beekeeping While Black, a virtual platform for building a community for Black beekeepers in the U.S. Producer Catrice Claudio spoke to Karen about her beekeeping experience and what motivated her to start the platform. Karen also talks about the mental health benefits of engaging with nature and beekeeping. But how did Karen come to love bees?
I always find it funny because when I talk to so many other beekeepers, they always have these prolific ways that they got into beekeeping. They wanted to go deeper into their work as farmers. During shutdowns in 2020, I started just playing The Sims, and it was a game that I played as a kid. Yeah. And I used to find that so much time would go by and not having to commute to work. I just didn't know what to do with my time. And so I just started playing The Sims, and I got an expansion pack that allowed you to have a bee box, as they call it in the game. And once I mastered the bee box, I just randomly thought, I could do that. And then I just started researching beekeeping, joined the DC Beekeepers Association, and took the course that they have. And I guess the rest is history from there, but not the most prolific way, but definitely revelatory in a very uncommon place.
I totally wouldn't discount that because I am a Sims fanatic, and I believe The Sims is a wonderful manifestation tool. So please, that is life-giving. So tell us more about your mission with Beekeeping While Black. It was something that I found interesting because we have beekeepers here in Hartford that are looking for community as well. So to think of it existing elsewhere, amazing. Tell me more about that.
Beekeeping While Black, it really came out of my own need for community, being transparent. Being a beekeeper in DC, I've been welcome and embraced in community. But what I found is that when I started taking the course for beekeeping, I found myself asking questions that I knew my white counterparts were not asking. And it became very isolating to me because I was asking questions that I knew no one else had to ask. And so thus, they probably didn't have the answers either. And so I found myself needing to find community, but I was struggling to find that. And it wasn't until I found Beekeeping While Black that I actually then was able to find where the Black beekeepers were. And so we've been building community since then through a virtual space for many of us, because many of us do tend to be more isolated in where we're located. And so for me, it was really just out of my own need to have community and to be able to find those people who maybe have answers, or at least they know the struggles that I'm facing as a Black beekeeper when it comes to where do you get hives placed? What do you do about your hair? Like, again, it's just pretty unique to me as a Black beekeeper.
What we do with our hair?
Yeah, so there's two things. One, it's not uncommon for beekeepers to use tools when we beekeep, including a smoker. And smoke goes everywhere, including your hair, especially in fabrics and hair. I remember the first time I used a smoker, because I don't typically use them, but I washed my hair the day before and straightened it. And then the next day, I unexpectedly, with my mentor, used a smoker. And then I thought, oh my gosh, I just did my hair. As I was going to bed later that night, I'm on the pillow and I'm like, I smell smoke in my hair. And so it was just things like that. Like, how do I avoid having my hair smoke? Or someone put in the African American beekeepers group, like, how do I help my child not smell like a furnace every time she uses a smoker? And so it was just as simple as, I can't wash my hair always immediately after. And since I have natural hair, I've learned to kind of time my showers most of the time, but that's not always possible. And so that's just one example for my hair. The second one would be, because I have natural hair, my hair is bigger. And so the suits that are often used, which often the veil is attached to the suit, and the veils are made for hair that doesn't have as much volume as mine. And so what happens is that if I have my hair out, if I have my hair even in a high bun, it can misplace where the veil lands on my face. And that in and of itself can actually be dangerous, because I have been stung in the face because the veil was too close to my face. And it allowed a bee to get close enough that it could actually pierce my skin. And so those are just the types of things that I do consider, even as down to the hair aspect of beekeeping.
So given that there is a real Black perspective, Black experience, and Black lens in beekeeping, how is your work focused around Black beekeepers as agents of food security?
We are Black beekeepers, but I think sometimes that people forget that that also means we're Black farmers. It's a niche aspect of farming. And so for us, it's the idea of, we're helping the environment, but we're also then helping our food system. And so part of it is really just owning that work and knowing that we are doing something that's contributing to just the overall ecosystem and the food systems for which our bees are placed. And so for us, it's really more so, how do we help beekeepers to be able to lean more into the identity of being Black farmers? And also, what does that mean when it comes to getting the resources and addressing the barriers and opportunities that come along with beekeeping and farming?
So there's a lot of connection, especially Afro-Indigenous connection, between our culture and the land. Can you talk more about the connection between beekeeping and mental health?
Studies have shown that it is very beneficial for people to be outdoors, and beekeeping is no different. You get to be outside, you get to be with the bees themselves, and the bees also have vibrations that come along with the humming and all the life that happens in the hive, and that has been shown to also help with some people as a bit of a therapy. I know for me, anytime I'm feeling depressed, when possible, I do go to my hive, because it's almost like a release for me emotionally to be able to go. And I feel more empowered after I leave the hive. And so for me, it is a bit of a therapy through, I guess, kinetics for me to go through that process. And a lot of other beekeepers have had the same experience. I think sometimes with beekeeping, especially because it's not typically perceived as something that Black people do, it's one that can be a path of self-discovery, a path of finding yourself, a path of getting more connected to the land. And I think that does wonders for people's mental health journeys and just being able to also feel connected to something bigger. Bees teach you a lot of life lessons. One of them being that you're not really in charge of anything. It's a very humbling experience. Because at the end of the day, the bees really dictate what you are even able to do as a beekeeper. And so it's really one of those things where you're really submitting to the acts of nature, to something larger than yourself, when you are going through the process of beekeeping.
The idea of the hum being such a soothing balm for some folks. I love sound bathing. And so that makes so much sense, especially with ASMR being so hot right now. So it sounds like a lot of this journey has been you reconnecting to the greater earth. And as an earth advocate, because this is an Earth Day episode, how do you celebrate Earth Day?
Well, I actually work at Creation Justice Ministries as my full-time job. So we are a Christian organization that does advocacy and trainings around environmental issues. So on Earth Day, I'll be with my colleagues and we'll do a service that's actually around reflecting on God's creation and the need to protect and care for it as a sense of our calls. Because sometimes for some people, this is the one time of the year that people actually get some type of education in their community around caring for the rest of the planet. And so that's really a lot of my time, either during, before, or after Earth Day, is really just speaking engagements and trying to do as much education as possible.
How does your faith inform your direction in this journey with nature?
It's pretty essential for me. It is a living out of my faith to care for the rest of the planet. In Genesis, it talks about how God gave Adam this responsibility to, well, translations would say to protect and serve. Some people say dominion, which is really should be seen more as stewardship. And so it actually is viewed for many people like me as the first call towards living out your faith is caring for the rest of creation. And an understanding that if we take care of the rest of creation, it will also in return take care of us. And that's part of where my theology is the understanding is that because we're not taking care of creation, it's now threatening to not take care of us. And so it's very much a part of my experience, and the way that I view my caring for creation is very much tied to the way that my faith is lived out. And when I say creation, that also means other humans, understanding that we're a part of the ecosystem as well.
What encouragement can you offer people who are wanting to be better stewards of our warming planet?
Too often there's people who are trying to deal with this existential threat as if it's already done. And I don't believe it. I actually have seen from the science, it feels like if we actually do more to take care of the land, to invest in our ecosystems, that will actually do a lot of the work needed in order to be able to stop and slow down climate change. And so for me, I think the hope in addressing the issue of climate and other issues is actually in taking care of the land. And there's so many ways that we can do that. I'm always a firm believer in that all work needs to lead to policy changes. And so there is policy as voters that we need to be able to do. But then there's also the opportunity of volunteer at a farm, invest if possible, if someone has the means to connect with your local farmer, beekeeper, whoever, but try to make your food system as much as possible more regional. The food would one be healthier, but also our food system is so can be such an issue for the planet. And so being able to have hope, I think, is being able to invest in those who are caring for our planet. And a lot of times that is small and medium scale farmers. But for me, I'm not done with this fight of protecting the planet. And so my hope is that there is work that we can still do, and that there's people who are doing the work and they just need more support to be able to do it and to scale it up.
I see that you also figured out a pathway to build community through the Honey Book on your website, Beekeeping While Black. How can people connect with you and each other to get in the directory and grow this community?
So if someone's interested in being in the Honey Book as a beekeeper, this is intended for people who are actually selling honey. All they have to do is either send me a message via social media or go to the website and send me a message through that, and I can put them onto the Honey Book. And then for those who are maybe not bee enthusiasts, but at least want to support, they can always go to the Honey Book. All it does is just give direct information to how to contact the beekeeper, whether that's through their number, their email, whatever avenue they want to best communicate. But being able to find someone who they can go to for local honey, because local honey is always the best honey. And so being able to support a beekeeper in that way. And again, as we support beekeepers, we're also supporting Black farmers.
That's fantastic. So it is a food show. And I have to ask, what is your favorite way to eat or cook with honey?
So this has been an interesting journey for me because I got my Hive and it was in that moment, another revelation that I had unexpectedly was like, Karen, you don't like honey. And so I spent the next year trying different foods to figure out how to actually enjoy honey. And so I like to bake with honey in particular. I like the sweetness that it adds to a recipe, especially some oatmeal cookies that I make. I think that just adds a little something extra. So I appreciate that. But when it comes to local honey, I actually try to not cook with it because the heat itself will reduce the nutrition value. So I'll try to put it in something very quick. And so I like to make spicy honey, which is actually very easy to make from home. And so you just put it in a mason jar, then put some peppers in it, and then let it sit in your windowsill for a few weeks as it gets direct sunlight. And then I'll top it on salmon, pizza, anything. So it's just a nice topper and it doesn't compromise the nutritional value of the honey that way. And also, I did realize that once I had honey, I'm completely biased, but honey was actually good once it was mine. And so once I had my own honey, I actually was able to enjoy it in tea and different things. And I think that was also realized that was probably my first time actually having true local honey was once I was able to extract from my own hive. And so I realized maybe it wasn't that I didn't like honey. I just didn't like that type of honey that I was buying.
I thank you so much for the work that you're doing in this community. I thank you so much for the effort you put in to educate our community and keep them bees buzzing.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm so glad to get connected with more people in this community.
That was Karen Bigelow, founder of Beekeeping Wild Black. Are you a Black beekeeper? Connect with Karen so she can add you to the online directory, The Honey Book. You'll find it on her website, beekeepingwildblack.com. And follow Karen's adventures on Instagram at beekeeping.wild.black. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. Season is produced by me and Catrice and
Meg Dalton,
Stephanie Stender,
Tegan Engel,
Meg Fitzgerald.
Our social team is Sabrina Herrera, Francesca Fontanez, Martha Castillo, Shanice Rule, Janae Spinato, and Catherine Jimenez. To keep up with the latest on Seasoned, follow at CT Public on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And we're at WNPR on X. Catch this and past episodes of Seasoned, covering everything from your favorite ice cream shops to community gardens and farmers markets, wherever you get podcasts. And subscribe so you never miss an episode. If you like the show, do us a favor and rate it on Apple Podcasts. It really does help other food lovers find us. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.